What? And I just wanted to confirm that's true.
Okay, let's take a step back, okay? It's a good way to open up an interesting question, okay? The way to respond when you hear things like that is not what, but you know, where does that come from? What is that base? Why do we keep it? Okay, nothing. There's a bit of a danger, which is especially acute in this world and in your world, called generationism, in which people think past generations in general were all Neanderthals and backwards and unscientific. And if you take a secular approach, and basically the whole world has evolved towards a better state, politically, economically, educationally, politically. So everything about the new world is advanced, everything about the old world is ancient and backwards. That's one pole. And then someone that, let's say, lives, I don't know, a hyper Haredi lifestyle, so you don't even go to doctors. So basically everything about the old world is superior, everything about the new world is decrepit, morally, religiously. We don't see education as evolving, we don't see politics as evolving, everything about the modern world is villainized and vilified. Most of us stand somewhere in the middle, and that's what makes being a frum Jew so difficult, because on the one hand, we do feel that the economy of capitalism is better than the economy of feudalism. And we do believe that democracy is better than monarchy. And we do believe that modern medicine trumps ancient voodoo. And we do believe that discovering the world is not round means that we open our eyes to new physics and new reality. But on the same token, we look back at the past as morally and religiously superior. So those who were closer to Har Sinai had a better transmission because it was less corrupt, right? If I tell you something and you pass it on, at a certain point it's going to be corrupted. So I'll tell you one thing, it's going to be corrupted something else. So Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misenim, Sarah Lisha, Vishul Eskenim, Eskenim, and as it made its way through the generations, it became corrupt. That's the Baralukim Chayim. So we don't believe that corruption is, this is more than one way to slice the eggs, more than one way to slice a Kodesh Baruch Hu's Torah, but that's a whole different conversation, not for now. So somehow we're forced with, on the one hand, living in the modern world, accepting the economy, accepting politics, accepting sociological change, accepting all, but still looking back to previous generations as being superior. So let's just get caught by, not disrespecting previous generations. The first stage is just because we feel that certain parts of society have evolved doesn't mean that morally and the accuracy of text has evolved and most likely has disintegrated and degenerated. Okay, that's one thing. Now, aside from that, the second danger is what some would call anachronism. When you take your own standards, take religion out of the conversation. Let's forget the fact that we defer to previous generations or closer to Har Sinai. Let's say for five minutes this were a conversation that were happening in Harvard or in Columbia. So we're not discussing religion. And we want to know, should we superimpose our standards of marriage or society back on previous generations? And if so, and if not, why not? So, for example, if I look back at Thomas Jefferson, and Thomas Jefferson had slaves, so does that mean he was immoral? Because when held up to 21st century standards, having slaves are immoral, we should pull down his statue. Or you can't expect people to transcend their own societal and cultural limit, as forward-thinking as they are. Just like there's certain assumptions you don't doubt about yourself, and maybe in 200 years those assumptions will be doubted by AI and other things. So in that world, people couldn't imagine, maybe not Jefferson, maybe 400 years before Jefferson, the way the world operated, the amount of manual labor that was necessary in order to build buildings, in order to feed one another. So in that world, they could not imagine a world without slave, and therefore wasn't even in there. Just like you wouldn't imagine yourself, I don't know, becoming a dog. It's out of the realm of a possibility. You don't think, why am I a woman? Why am I a man, not a dog? Because you just take that as an assumption. You wake up and you're a human being. You're a Homo sapien. You don't question why you're not a virus. So in those days, slavery was so necessary they didn't question. So to be careful about anachronism in a way that's very often condescending, and it's a self-inflicted humiliation because you're making yourself sound dumber than the people you think are dumb because you're not able to imagine a society other than your own. The third stage of that equation, before we get to your question, is forget avoiding anachronism because they couldn't outlast their own world, but is our system actually superior? So we're still in Harvard. We're not creating that dichotomy where we automatically defer to previous generations religiously, even though we feel the world has evolved. We're questioning, have we evolved? Even if we have evolved, maybe they couldn't evolve, but through no fault of their own. But the third level to that question is, have we evolved? Is marriage today superior than marriage 2,000 years ago? So marriage today is romantic. Marriage 2,000 years ago is economic and political and societal, two families merge. So we look back and go, oh my goodness gracious, this marriage is. But it's not true. Every change in society brings certain benefits. Every change brings certain disadvantages. So the freedom of women and the equalization of the workforce and voting and all has been accompanied by a lot that has led to the de-dignification of women, or the undignification of women, because of pornography and because of that you can have one with the other. Of course you can, but unfortunately that's not the way society operates. So let's say, not just anachronistic, let's say we're looking at the people in Beitar who get married after meeting each other 4 or 5 dates. You look at that and say, oh my goodness, that's crazy, that's caveman, that's Neanderthal. You know what? The divorce rates aren't really higher in that society. Nor, for that matter, are the marriage counseling rates. So as far as all the metrics suggest, their marriages are just as blissful as our marriages. LMI, you're entering with a different set of expectations. You're expected to find someone who becomes your soulmate and to know each other and to fall in love and they get married. They're saying, you know what, I'm going to use marriage as an opportunity to fall in love. So I'm going to find someone that more or less, I like the way they look, more or less our families are the same, more or less our values are the same, but their parameters for falling in love are not your parameters for falling in love, and it's all a spectrum of difference, and you're not better or worse. So those are the three things to avoid when you're comparing your own reality, where we talk about food under the bed, is number one, okay, we defer to previous generations halachically and morally. Number two, even when we're questioning non-religious and moral issues, just societal issues, people live within their context. You can't blame Chazal for thinking the world was flat because that's the science they had available. In the same way we mock people for 500 years ago, believe me, your grandkids are going to have a hell of a time laughing at you when they see your cell phone and when they see you traveling in these big aluminum tin cans rumbling across the heavens and they see you putting fossil fuel into your car when they're driving around and fusion energy. Like, they're going to have a really, really hard time laughing at you, just like you're laughing at previous generations. So look back with humility, intellectual humility, and also don't assume that your system is always better. Every system brings change. Some of the changes are advances, some of the changes are retreats. Okay, that's just the introduction to the question, which is always much more important than the question. I've taught you that this year. Forget the question. The questions are always, I mean, say this in a bad way, stupid little specific points. But they touch upon larger issues of life and perspective, and every question is a tip of an iceberg. And think about what it represents, because those are global, those are systemic, those are going to affect all of your life. So now, we're facing this issue. This issue is based on the fact that Kabbalah was always much more influential and always much more impactful into their lives than it is today. Why it's not no longer that impactful? A range of reasons. But we can all say that we've lived through the last 400 years of rationalization, both in the general culture, the age of science, the age of reason, the Renaissance, as well as within the Jewish world. What's the interaction between the two? Good question. Did the Jewish world become so rational because the world around them became rational? Were there independent forces, internal forces? Girls, it's always both. Jewish change is always a product of both. Internal engines and external drivers. So we're living in a much more rational world where the average person doesn't study Kabbalah. And I've told you many times, Kabbalah isn't voodoo, Kabbalah isn't hocus pocus. Kabbalah is a rational, cognitive system. It's not empirical, you can't prove it. So I can prove how this phone will work by the physics and the electricity of it. I can't prove ideas that come from worlds that I can't enter. I just have to take them as accepted truths. In that world, there were certain Kabbalistic elements that don't make sense to us because we're viewing them through rational lenses, and you can't judge empirical lenses. You can't judge Kabbalah through empiricism because there's no way to prove where the food under your bed is dangerous. Shalom.
Shalom.
Sorry,
I'm sorry. Who is going to be in the
Ramazan? Okay. Now. Okay. Now, let's bring this home, girls, okay? Now. Most of Kabbalah, we're not even aware of. It's practiced by Mekubalim, so you do visit Mekubal if you need to. You don't visit Mekubal, that's a whole separate conversation. However, the Shulchan Aruch, which was written by Rabbi Yosef Kaira, who lived, let's get a little information, who lived in Svart, he was 3 years old in 1492, I think he was born 1489 or something, 1492, five-year-old, three-year-old, he was expelled with his family, he made his way slowly to Svart. He was very, very heavily influenced by Kabbalah. Who was the restorer of Kabbalah in the 16th century in Sfat? The Ari HaKadosh. So there's a whole renaissance of Kabbalah. So he introduces a lot of Kabbalah into Halacha. And generally, even people that are not Mekubalim will still be more sensitive to Kabbalistic elements that are found in the Shulchan Aruch. And they affect primarily areas that are what should I just say, a little bit, not esoteric, but a little bit beyond sleeping and death, sexuality, because the stakes are so high because you're bringing children into the world. So I was just in South Africa over Shabbos, and someone asked me over Yom Tov why the burial ceremonies in Israel look like voodoo, and as I'm going through Levaya today, and they're so tightly regulated, and women can't follow the kever, and I don't know if you've ever been to a burial in Eretz Yisrael, but there's a whole group of Hasidim right before the burial that will work in a circle around the mace, holding each other's garblach, incanting certain incantations under their breath, throwing gold chips in the sky after every move around, breaking a pottery dish. What does it mean? I don't know. But you know what? No one knows it's on the other side. So I can't tell you it's meaningless because I can't tell you anything. Like, maybe it has a meaning. No. When you reach these areas, you don't know what's on the other side. So right away, you're suspending your rationing. Because I can't. I can analyze the math equation. I can analyze the scientific phenomena. I can't analyze death. So if you tell me that's the way it works, I'm a little bit more sensitive. You know what? Maybe that's the way it works. Death and birth and sexuality, which obviously, you know, do I really know the relationship between my own mode of my own mentality during sexuality and how that affects my child? I don't know. I don't know how Kodesh Baruch Hu is choreographed. I can break down the science for you, but obviously there's more than the science. When a sperm and an egg fertilize, okay, that's the science. But sperm and egg can also fertilize an amoeba. When they fertilize a human being, obviously there's an endowment of soul by Kodesh Baruch Hu. I don't know how that happens. So all of a sudden, when you reach your limits, Kabbalah becomes a little bit more impactful. Now, what about us? When I say us, is people from our world, right? We're more or less in the same world. So most of us will not pay that much attention to Kabbalah, even if it's in the Shulchan Aruch, unless it also has a non-Kabbalistic reference point. So for example, I'll give you a perfect example, Netilas Yadayim. Okay? So Netilas Yadayim is right on that edge, as we call it, Negel Vasser in the morning, between Halacha and Kabbalah. The Halacha is you have to prepare for davening. So you prepare for davening by washing your hands with a cup. Real Netila, because your hands are going to become impure at night by touching parts of your body that normally meant, I don't want to say impure, it's a bad word, we don't have a better word for Tumah. Tumah doesn't mean impure like you're dirty or you're disgraceful, it means in a non-ritually pure state because you'll touch parts of the body that render you non-ritually pure, right? Sometimes, especially when people use the word Nida, you're impure. What do you mean impure? It's the most beautiful part of a woman's life cycle, the ability to have children. Yeah, impure just means you can't be in the base of Mikdash during that period, you can't eat Trumah during that period. Okay, now, Chazal also say, the Kabbalah says that there's something called a Ruach Ra that is on the people's hand. That after night, there's some irrational, Kabbalah-based, dangerous force that's associated with your fingers. And therefore, you should wash your hands. So most people in our world are not so much, but on the Ruach Ra part. I'll tell you the difference. But we do Negel Vasser anyway because it has a halachic element. Whereas you may find, if you go to a hospital and you go to a postnatal ward, you'll find some people who are really sensitive to Kabbalah will actually go and perform Negel Vasser on their one-day-old infant. They'll take the little baby and they'll wash the little baby's cute little fingers and they'll put it. Why? Because if you really take the Ruach Ra seriously, you don't want the baby taking the Ruach Ra and touching his eyes. Don't make fun of it. It's not your approach. It's not our approach. It's not my approach. But another example. So people who have the Netilas Yadayim under their bed. Have you seen the people with the wash basin? Why? Because if you take the Ruach Ra seriously, then you are not supposed to let that Ruach Ra last in your fingers more than 4 amos. Those who don't have the basins under the bed, like myself, either say, you know what, since I don't practice Kabbalah, it's not that I don't take it seriously, oh my goodness, it's all bunk and it's all wrong. It means that I choose not to play in that league. You can choose a league that you play in. You can choose to say, you know what, I'm not going to play and I'm not going to be impacted by Kabbalah's truth, nor am I going to press those levers. I'm going to take my world and frame it around halacha. I'm going to use halacha as the sole determinant of my practice. And or you can choose, you know, I'm going to be involved in Kabbalistic reality. So to a degree, you can choose the system that will impact you and that you will impact. And I choose not to draw upon Kabbalistic elements, right? Take someone like Madonna. That's like the most imbalanced and asynchronous. I'll just pick Kabbalistic elements that I feel, you know, will help me. As opposed to saying, I'm going to study and be a Mekubal and study my whole life and then enter the world of Kabbalah, and I've made a decision not to enter that world. So that's the way to answer that question. There's certain things that were very powerful in the world of Kabbalah, and powerful because it had to do with sleep. And sleep, you're basically dying, you're delivering your soul back to Kodesh Baruch Hu. You don't control this, you're going to wake up, right? You don't control it, you're going to wake up. When you're sleeping, you're unconscious. So something's happening to your consciousness. And you could describe the neurological element of it, but we believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was taking you in a shamble, the kind of shamash and it's not to be. So because sleep has that death-like mysterious. We can't really explain the metaphysics of it, so that's why it's more associated with Kabbalah. So, yes, the answer is you can keep food under your bed. I would tell you not to keep food on your bed just because it's gross. Because you want your sleeping environment to be more dignified and it's going to smell again. That's already relative. When you're younger, it's less of an issue, right? You're sleeping in dorms and, you know, I know what dorms are like. Trust me, I once was in a dorm. Put it this way. My Babi Allah Shalom came to visit me in Grush in 1984. She wanted to see my room and I said, Babi, I lost the key. So, and she like went for it and then on her deathbed, like she looked at me and said, you didn't really lose the key. Okay, you got me there. So, you don't want to put food under your bed because rats will come because it's not dignified to live that way. But
it's like a camp situation.
Yeah, you can put food under your bed.
It's emergency chocolate.
Awesome.
But again, what I really want you to train yourself to do is, okay, that question, yes or no. You didn't need me to give you that answer. You could have got to it on your own. So I want to say, you know, we don't follow Kabbalah anymore. I want you to see the background because all the things that I mentioned are going to help you navigate all these areas of life and hopefully in a sophisticated, pious and nuanced fashion. It's very easy just to reject everything. It's very easy just to blindly accept everything. It's important to be able to drill down and know what you're doing and why you're doing it and know how to put things in perspective. You know, so some people who are very sensitive to Kabbalah, you know what, that's great. That's fine. I'll just tell you a story that has to do with the Tehillat HaDayan just because I touched upon it. Has anyone ever heard of Avram ben Avram, the Ger Tzedek? Oh my goodness, you guys know basics. Okay. I wrote in one of my articles a couple of weeks ago. I was once on a panel. They asked me, what area of education is insufficiently taught in American high schools? So they expected me to say, Bikiyas, Iyun, Gemara, Chumash, Tanakh. You know what it really is? Jewish history. If you have no Jewish history, you have no context. You have no... To really know like where we came from, how we evolved, how we're here, just really thorough. If you're looking for like things to listen to and podcasts, and just do me a favor, try to get into it. You'll see it will give you a context and a fabric to your Avodas Hashem, rather than just, here I am, it's 2023, how to become a good Jew, and you're part of something larger, there's a verticality, or part of some heritage. And so this is a good Shavuot story. Okay, this is Poland, early 1800s. Now, Poland, early 1800s, is not the Poland of the 20th century, nor the Polish drugs. Poland of the early 1800s is the Empire of Poland, basically all of Central Europe. They basically go out of business in the 18th century because they get gobbled up by the Russian Empire, by the German Empire, by the Prussian Empire. And the modern Poland is some pale shadow. But this was the major empire of Central and Eastern Europe in the 1600s, 1700s, and until the late 1700s. And, of course, they were ruled by a small, limited class of oligarchs or magnates. They owned, this was feudalism at its best. This was top-of-the-line feudalism. One of the largest mafia families, more mafia, one of the largest families were the Pataki family. This is a very, very large landowner, Polish Jew. And one of their noblemen, I think it was Victor or something, I forget what his name was, the duke, he had some name, decided, again, there's tons of legends about this. It's a very legendary story. He was in Paris, he met a Jew, he started studying the Bible. All of a sudden, he decided this whole Christianity stuff, it's a bunch of baloney. I want to be Jewish. Man, so first of all, it was hard for him to find someone to convert him because, you know, if any Beis Din in the Polish Empire would have converted their top superstar nobleman, that would be the last time they ever met. They would have been burned at the stake because the Jews are meant to become Christian, not vice versa. Okay, so he had no place to convert. The only place that a Christian could convert to Judaism in the 1700s was where? Anyone know? Was the most liberal Jewish community? Anyone know? Not England, Avital. Actually, it was right after Cromwell. So the Jews were allowed back, but the Jews of England had a charter. Part of their charter when they were invited back by Cromwell was, we're not going to convert any Christians. So if you begged the Dayanim in England to convert, they said, no way, we don't convert. The only place was, come on?
Paris.
No. Still today. What's the most liberal, multicultural city in all of Europe?
Amsterdam.
That's where the Amsterdam Jews. Go to Amsterdam. They'll convert you. Because Amsterdam is very wealthy. The Jews are wealthy. It's all good. Everyone. We don't judge anyone in Amsterdam. And of course, a lot of the people came from Amsterdam to America, near Amsterdam, and that's how a lot of the liberalism spread to America. It wasn't really the liberalism of the Puritans. It was the liberalism of the Dutch who originally colonized America, really, that set the tone, Stuyvesant, and set the tone in America. And he gets converted. For some reason that no one knows, he goes back to Poland. Bad idea. after the University of Judaism, he goes back to Poland, and he hangs out in Vilna. How do you get to Vilna? It's hard to know. It's part of the legend. Attracted to the Vilna Gaon, who was probably about 20 years old, so it's hard to know why. And he's, again, this is all legend. I mean, the skeleton of the story is true, but all these other legends, it's hard to prove. But he's sitting in the Beis Medrash one day in Vilna, incognito, with like a little Groucho Marx, you know, mustache, don't you know, to recognize him, you know, a little beard, a perv, you know, don't you know who he is? He's sitting and learning, and some boy comes by and starts making a racket, little child. So he looks at the boy, he says, shut up already, you're bothering me, I'm trying to learn. You know, it happens from time to time, right? So the father gets all involved, why are you bullying my son? Father comes to the Beis Medrash, says, okay, I'm going to rat you out. And he rats him out to the Polish authorities, right? One of the unspoken crimes of Jewish history is the amount of malshinim. When you say every day, v'olam malshinim al tehi sikva v'chol ha'risha k'rega tovei, so the risha, the rishayim, and the zedim we know, but the malshinim were the Jews who ratted out other Jews. I mean, that's, we don't talk about that much, but it was all over. Remember, in Spanish Inquisition, if you knew a Jew who was secretly practicing Judaism and you didn't rat him out, should they what happened to you? You were drawn and quartered. Anyone know what drawn and quartered means?
Yes.
Okay. Not a pleasant sight. Well, let's put it this way. You were cut up to pieces in small installments while you were still alive to watch your body being cut up. So it's not as if all these malshinim were such mendacious and dastardly people. You just had to protect yourself. So this guy was malshin on him. And then, of course, the story gets, who knows, drama, melodrama. They bring him and they torture him and they have a court case against him. And basically, the story goes that he was so wealthy, this Pataki family was so wealthy, that he could have gotten off. They just said, you know, say this. Here's a good line. Just say you were drunk. Just say you're out of your mind. Just make up some cover story, and we'll just look the other way. But as a good guy would say, no, I want to be honest. If he were Jewish, he was a guy. He wanted to be honest. If he were Jewish, he probably would have played games. But since he was a guy, he says, no, I converted to Judaism. I'm going down with the ship. And basically they tortured him, and he's Makadosh Shem Shemayim, and the Gaon was there, wasn't there. They put ashes of his grave in the Vilna Gaon. They buried him with the Vilna Gaon. There's a lot of Vilna Gaon.
Isn't that the family with the really gorgeous house in the shul nearby?
Yeah, so Avram ben Avram in Vilna.
Yeah.
So Avram ben Avram, and look up on the internet, all these stories in Avram ben Avram. Anyway, the story goes that he was massacred or martyred on the second day of Shavuos, which of course, like, wow. You know, if you have to be a Ger Tzedek who's being martyred, what's your day? It's the day of Rus. Like, we read Rus. It's like, it can't be any more heavenly ordained than a Ger Tzedek in the middle of the darkest period of Poland who converts and is massacred and martyred on the second day of Shavuos, when we all read Rus. Here's the point I was saying. There's an old Masara from the Chafetz Chaim, okay, that when he died, he said the bracha of Mekadesh Shmo Barabim, which is the bracha you recite when you're Moshe Nevesh HaKadosh Hashem, with so much kavana that he evicted the Ruach Ra from the world. And that after him, we no longer have to worry about the Ruach Ra within the Tehillah Sedayim. And that's why people today are makil not to put the water under the bed. Now, I don't know how to explain that to you, but I don't know, I'm not doubting the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim lived closer to that story than me. He had Masoras that I don't have. So the Chafetz Chaim says that even if you are a Ruach Ra warrior, we don't have to worry anymore about the Ruach Ra, because one person's action could be so impactful and so fateful that it changes the metaphysics of the Ruach Ra in our world. Because obviously, the more Mekadosh Shem Shemayim, the less Ruach Ra there'll be. So anyway, that's just a nice post-Shavuos story. Avram ben Avram. Look it up on the internet. Anyway, yes.
So I have a question, but then I had a second question on part of the answer when you said about.
Oh my goodness, too complicated for me.
When you said about like sort of opting out of the realm of Kabbalah, how can you sort of opt out of something that's part of Judaism?
Very simply, very simple.
They're different.
No. Whoa. You can't. No, it's a parallel system, and you could decide whether that should be a part of your life, how much you want to be conscious of it, how much you want to be impacted of it. And again, you can't say it's wrong, and when the Shulchan Aruch filters certain Kabbalistic truths, that becomes part of the baseline of halacha. But you can say, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates different systems within which you can operate.
So can someone operate entirely within Kabbalah and not in halacha?
No, because you can't build Kabbalah without halacha. Halacha is normative. But you can build halacha without Kabbalah and say, I'm not going to worry about the Kabbalah. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that I have the right to operate completely in the world of Nigla. Now, could that be 800 years ago? Maybe not. Maybe 100 years ago, people felt that Kabbalah was too preponderant in their lives and you couldn't create an alternate reality sans Kabbalah without Kabbalah. But today, most people, most halachic participating people, do not think about Kabbalah. At most will say, well, if the Beis Yosef introduced it into halacha, it is halacha-sized Kabbalah. Mm-hmm. Look, this is going to be very Mirta Shem in a couple of years when you get married. So this entire section in the end of the Shulchan Aruch of Aruch Chaim, in the last couple of simanim, which tells you what you should be thinking about during marital relations in order to affect the Kabbalistic connection between your relations and the child you'll have and how you'll make sure that your child. By and large, we don't keep them. Why? Because by and large, we feel that in our day, that thought process could block the romance and the camaraderie and the connection that we're trying to create. Now, in a period in which romance was less prominent, and I told you all the time, sexuality is very different. And when Chazal speak in terms that we find abhorrent and we find, oh, Pesach Pasuach, and if you know these terms in the Gemara Ksuvah, they have a debate about whether a woman was a Pasula and not a Pasula, and they talk in ways which to us would be somewhat pornographic and just disrespectful to people. Sexuality wasn't a core part of their identity. It was like saying, you know, what do you have for dinner tonight? It didn't carry the same baggage. What makes rape such a terrible crime today is not the sex, in addition to the sexuality of it, you're typically stealing someone's identity. Your identity is your sexuality, and something very private and you share with only one person, when someone invades that private space, they've taken away who you are. That's why the victimhood and the trauma lasts for decades. And I'm not saying rape wasn't a crime in those days, but it's different. Oh, how good the rape is in those days? There are many, many answers to that question, but rape in those days wasn't the horrific, terrible crime that it was today. It's still a crime today because of the psychology of it. You're essentially disembodying a person. You're taking a person and just gutting them psychologically. And you know, that's why it's such a terrible one with other crimes. Okay, what was your primary question?
So if you go into politics and you're Jewish, are you required to vote and produce legislation that is in line with halachic values, or can you kind of vote contrary to it? Like if you're in the parliament and there's a bill about gay rights or abortion, something like that, do you have to vote in line with halacha?
I mean, it's very, you have to ask the question on two levels, halachic commandments and halachic spirit. You know, if there's going to be, you know, let's say there's going to be a legislation that will tell people you have to have homosexual relations tonight. So that's a violation of halacha. You can't be a messiah. So there are clear and strict halacha guidelines that govern. You have to mechal Shabbos, you have to eat pork. I mean, you can't be an assistant. Again, if it's only a legislation that goyim will keep, then you have no problem with that. Maybe unless things are aser for goyim. But in most cases, you're not legislating the execution of averus. You're legislating laws that will create environments that may be against the spirit of halacha. You're not telling people, you're telling people you can get married homosexually. No, you're not telling them they have to have sexual relations. You're saying you can live with so-and-so. Is two homosexuals getting married, is that a violation of halacha? No, when they have homosexual activity, it is a violation of halacha. So
in a country where it is, like, let's say Nigeria, where it is forbidden, and if you're a Jewish politician in Nigeria, what would you do then?
So again, in the spirit of halacha or actual halacha? So am I legislating something that will lead to halachic infraction? Or am I legislating something that will lead to the behavior and culture and attitudes that are generally against the halacha? Those are two very separate questions. Is my legislation going to directly encourage and incite the performance of a virus? I cannot be behind that legislation. If my legislation will lead to non-halachic elements in the culture, so again, if Jews aren't going to be affected, and those are not areas of halacha that really affect goyim, like mitzvahs of shatnez or things that goyim don't have to keep, then I'm more comfortable. If it's going to be areas that Jews will be influenced by, I'd be less comfortable because I know that I'm having a role not just in assisting halachic infraction, but in leading people away from the spirit of halacha. I was separated that way in terms of goyim. To what degree do I have an interest in making sure that goyim keep the general morality behind the Shabbos? I have an interest, but it's not as important to me right now as that Jews should keep the halacha in the spirit. I'd be less concerned with the overall issue. Okay? Yes?
Okay. So, for a 19 year, so I'm also been learning Masechet Brachot this year. And there's a lot of like bathroom talk and a lot of like whatever. And so me and my chavrusa were talking about it, and we were like, why? Gemara is not baseline halacha. Like a lot of our halacha is derived from the Gemara, but it's not the same thing. And I enjoy learning Gemara, the key at least. But like, why? What's the value? Like a lot of, and I'm not saying that like what they thought wasn't like correct at the time or whatever. But what's the value in learning a lot of like maybe incorrect? Like what we know in medicine now isn't what they were saying then, and like the bracha that they tell us to say aren't what we actually say. So what's the value in learning?
Okay, look, it's a very, very good question. Let me tell you a story, okay? A story from a different field of a different discipline. It's a personal story. And then you'll understand, I'll bring it back to your question, okay? I was a graduate student for literature. And I felt like, at least in the field of English literature, roughly between the era of the 16th century and the 20th century, I thought there was real value that studying that literature could provide. Now, the problem is you can't cherry pick. It's not like there's a rabbi that's going to write, these are the 20 most influential works of literature in that period for Yeshiva Bachram to see. A, because it doesn't exist. B, because there's something called holism. And you have to see context, you have to see background, you have to see culture. To understand Hilton, you have to know within which culture he was operating. To understand Wordsworth, you have to understand which culture he was revolutionizing, how he was revolutionizing poetry. So you can't study anything in a vacuum, you know, which I said before about Jewish history. So I remember being in one class, I remember in the graduate school class, I always like to joke because I was in graduate school during the first Gulf War. And during the first Gulf War between America and the Allies against Iraq, 95% of the Americans were supportive of the war. This was a very Republican era, Reagan and Bush. It wasn't the woke culture today. Like 95% of the people supported the war, except for the real, real hyper left-wing hippies who would oppose any war whatsoever because war causes suffering, even though this seemed like a legitimate war because you're protecting Kuwait and whatever. So I like to joke, 5% of America opposed the war, and they're all in my graduate school class. It's a very, very liberal-minded graduate school. They're all sitting around, whatever. So we're sitting around discussing William Blake. William Blake was an English poet, very important English poet. And in addition to his poetry, he was a little bit, as we would say, off the rails. He sat with his wife in his garden in good old Mother England reading poetry without clothing on because they wanted to reproduce Adam and Eve. And in addition, he would write these illuminated plates to be associated with his poetry. Very, very creative thing. It was very deeply influenced by him. Very imaginative. He built like these alternate, it was like a science fiction poet. And he had these very, very imaginative plates. Now, a lot of them weren't exactly PG. Again, it wasn't like real pictures, but they were renditions of, and you know, I'm sitting there in the classroom and the teacher's only got plate one, plate two, and plate three, and I'm like looking here and looking there, like at some point I could pick my head up, but I'm looking, you know, down the business end of like really, really ugly plates. I remember running to the bathroom, like basically vomiting. Like, it was so disgusting to me. And I said, like, why am I here? Like, this is what I signed up to. I'm a yeshiva bachur. I'm not here to, I'm not a sleazy pervert looking for, like, what's happening to me? And then I said, but you know what? I'm not going to understand what I need to understand. I'm not going to look at them. I'm not going to gaze, but I have to study. I can't study. I can't understand all the poets unless I understand Blake. And St. Blake has a general sense of, so even though those plates to me were Narishkeit, and in this case, not just Narishkeit, but things that I felt very uncomfortable with. Namely, context is everything. Okay? So now getting back to your question. We believe that Chazal were part of this 600-year period that was unparalleled in Jewish history, where people built Torah Shebal Peh and decoded Hashem's will and explored the depths and mysteries of Hashem's will. And really, once you get to study, not just Bekiyas, but if you read, believe me, I've studied a lot of brilliant people. I've met brilliant people. There's nothing like the brilliance of Chazal, their mastery, their command, their logic, what I wouldn't give to be back sitting at the feet of Rava, sitting at the feet of Rav Kahana, sitting at the feet of these people, and like feeling the Torah and seeing the Torah that I takes me hours and hours and hours to decode maybe a line of their logic. Now, because I don't want to just understand their halachic statements, I also want to be part of the culture. I want to understand what they said to one another. I want to understand where they lived. I want to understand the conversations they had with one another. Because that will give me context, because it's a little bit more about Abaya. Even if there's not going to be anything more rational, but existential, because all of knowledge is not just cognitive, it's also existential. The more you identify with someone, the more you'll understand them. So identification and emotional, that's one of the most underrated parts of learning and studying is the emotional. Rav Chaim once told me that if you don't understand the Tosfos, it's not an intellectual flaw, it's a moral flaw. What does that mean? If you cared more about Tosfos, you'd work harder to understand Tosfos. So care and identification and association means you'll understand it better and you'll internalize it deeper because you really, right, I keep telling you, one of the most underrated parts of learning today is internalization. People are consuming a lot, but they're not internalizing much. And it's leading to shallowness. There's a lot of he said, and he said, and he said, and he said, and he said, people, oh, this Parsha, another Parsha, and another Parsha article, and you collect, have a good repertoire at the table. Work hard at taking ideas and wisdoms and making them part of your neshama. And they affect you, and that's why looking at the wisdoms behind the particular question is so important. It will change the way you lead your life. You'll be someone that leads a life that's deep and resonant, rather than the little tidbits of information. So I really want to understand who Rava was, and I want to read his biography, and I want to hear the conversations that naturally came up, because the Gemara wasn't written as a math book of formulas. It was written based on conversations that took place. And a lot of the conversations were ad hoc, and they were sitting by the river, and they were discussing business, and they were discussing the wedding the night before. And I really want to know what went on in those weddings, because it will help me identify more with them. Now, part of that is climbing into their world of science, and seeing the way they saw the world of science for two reasons. A, because even though we know the science has been debunked, it will help me understand them better. Second of all, they saw incorrect science, but they saw incorrect science through the lenses of Torah. So even if it was incorrect, there were certain, it's not, remember, true and false is not binary. So certain parts of the science which were false, but certain parts of the science, metaphysics at least, which were true. So maybe the actual science was false. They thought the earth was flat and the earth is really round. But there are a lot of metaphysical elements about why HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Like, ask yourself, why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu create a world that would seem flat? That's an interesting question. Hashem didn't create a world in which water feels like solids. That wasn't a big mystery. It's not like it took thousands of years for human beings to discriminate between solids and liquids. Fire and water, pretty obvious. So why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu not just create a world which was obviously round? That's an interesting question to me. And if I can wrestle with that question through their lenses, because these are the people that I lean on for my wisdoms, at some point I want to feel that. I'm not going to practice their medicine, but I'm interested to know, A, what they said about the medicine, B, who knows? I can't tell you that their medicine is off. I just know that we don't have access to those medicinals. But there's a whole world of herbal medicine and non-Western medicine that maybe one day we'll rediscover. So it's not binary, it's true or false, but there's certain things that are incorrect, at least right now, and some of them I think will remain incorrect. Like, for example, I don't think we'll ever prove the world is flat. But maybe we will discover spontaneous generation. They believed in spontaneous generation. We've discovered all the organisms that are left to discover. Science is dynamic. Today's science is tomorrow's alchemy. And tomorrow, certain scientific truths will be disproven. So I don't give it the same credibility. I don't really spend as much time reading them, but it's not like, I certainly don't mock them. And being that it was incorporated by very smart people like Ravina and Ravashi, I'll read it when the Daf Yomi comes up. I'm not going to spend hours and hours and hours reading the seventh parak of Gittin and seeing how they dealt with the epilepsy and with fainting. I'd rather go to the hospital if I need and get that medicine. So again, it's a nuanced approach. Some people say, if Chazal said it, they can't be wrong. Some people say, oh, Chazal, a bunch of cavemen. All they talked about were eggs and oxes and their sciences. No, they're talking about really deep ideas, but they were a product of the science of their times, and we can't expect them to surpass the science of their times and nap it as best they could. I really want to hear what they have to say, but I'm not going to give it the same attention and the same airtime. Okay?
Can you just talk more about this, specifically the science of our times? Are there limits to what we can, advance in science, halachically? And what are some issues?
Look, you've hit on the question. That's the question right now. See, the problem with technology is that technology accelerates faster than ethics. So people who are ethicists and think about it in halachas, especially in halacha, because a lot of people that are really good in halacha are very, very insular in their encounter with culture. So they only encounter culture the last possible minute. Right? So the same thing today. Right? How many rabbanim can really speak to you about social media, which is not a real game changer culturally. I mean, it's not like a change, but no, it's not a game changer technologically, it's a game changer culturally. But how many rabbanim are really, on social media? And they default to the simplistic, don't look at bad pictures and don't spread gossip, where there's so many more cultural undertones to social media that Bnei Torah and Bnei Torah have to be concerned about, not just bad pictures and bad times. There's so many other things. And so the same thing is, you know, we're really at that moment with AI and transhumanism. We are going to make hybrid human beings at some point. We're going to make higher intelligence, higher beings. I mean, just think, in 20 years, our fuel sources will be different. We're not going to burn fossil fuels. All of our food will be manufactured in the laboratories. That's obvious. And we're going to be dealing with AI. It's going to be a totally different world. Totally different world. And I think people have to start really thinking about that. I think even non-religious people in terms of the world have started to worry about how cataclysmic and how apocalyptic those changes could be. It's a really exciting time to live, a really scary time to live. And I call it, it's our Eitz Hadas. I feel like we're standing by the Eitz Hadas, literally. We're about to eat from the Eitz Hadas, and we're ever going to be changed. In general, whenever there is an opportunity to improve the human condition, and you feel that it will improve the human condition, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is on that side. Hashem is the Melech Rachamim V'chesed V'chayim. Hashem wants us, Simshalim Tov V'Avracha. He wants human beings to prosper. So the general trend is that technological and scientific advance and improvement is the Ratzon Hashem. Part of the issue is we just don't know the long-term impacts of some of these improvements. So it seems like AI will improve our lives, but who's to tell in 35 years or 200 years whether it will not improve our lives, as with all technology. But generally, we don't flinch. We follow halacha, so when it comes to crossbreeding, when it comes to, like, there's no halacha about cloning. There's no halacha about cloning DNA. There is halacha about not mixing and matching. So if we just clone within the species, you're not violating any halacha. If you take some DNA from this species, some DNA from that species, then there are halachic problems to be concerned. So generally, we follow halacha. But again, halacha didn't address some of the issues that we're currently facing. And at that point, you may have to say it's not in the spirit of the halacha and hold back. So I think the general inclination is we're pro-technology, we're pro-advance, we're pro-tikkun olam. We think HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to have a better world. From an ethical standpoint, we have to worry. We obviously have to, if there are any halachic infractions. And I think that, you see, what's confusing people now is, for the first time in history, we're being asked to think about impacts in 50 years and 100 years, not in 5 years. And because our potential is so strong, and because we have the data to project thought, like, who would have thought of global warming 200 years ago? Because we didn't have the tools to measure the temperature of the planet. So it wasn't in our wheelhouse, like, how hot is the planet and where are we heading? So people thought in installments of 5 or 10 years. Now we're starting to think in installments of 50, 100 years. We just don't know what that means. Like, what does it mean to think about how it will impact hundreds of years? It's a human issue. It's also a Jewish issue. I think Jews probably have an easier time thinking because we live multi-generational. Like, we do think about what's going to happen in 200 years. At least it's in our mind frame. Like, what will happen when Mashiach comes, and how am I going to help that? And when I leave this earth, like, you know, it's. I was just like reading the newspaper, not the newspaper, reading like one of the internet articles about Tina Turner. I mean, Tina Turner, so this musician was Nisteris. And like, they were very, to a degree, impressed because she died with, I think, 2 stepchildren, a couple grandchildren, a couple great grandchildren. Like, that was very, very irregular for a Hollywood celeb. You know, you're an average Jewish person, especially today in our world, like your grandparents, and they're still alive. Many of you are great grandparents, but because of extending lifespan, most people have. I'm going to a Levi today of someone that, you know, has multiple great grandchildren. And you all hope, right? If you like, close your eyes and imagine what you hope to see, how many generations you hope to see in your life. You all more or less expect to see 4 generations, right? More or less. You hope you have children, you hope you have grandchildren, and you hope that you'll have a healthy amount of great grandchildren. It's not something, you know, beyond. So I don't think most non-Jews process it that way. But remember, we process it both ways, right? How many generations can you enumerate in your past? Most people, 5, 6, in general sense. You know everyone's name and 2 dot zehut number and their weight and height, but you know who your parents are, you know who your grandparents were, you know your great-grandparents were. You more or less are able to go back 3 or 4 generations. That's not common. When you sit and talk to your non-Jewish friends, not because they don't have it. I'm talking about people who are genealogically disrupted. They just don't think that way. They can tell you the grandparents one, more or less. I can go back 10 generations. Like, I have a sense of where I came from, and most of us. And again, keep in mind, that's already with the Holocaust interruption, because the Holocaust is a huge interruption, because it erased large parts of the tree. obviously, if you're here, then your part of the tree wasn't erased. But you know, it's always easier when you have the bigger tree. Oh, there's Uncle and so-and-so. And so, great-uncle or great-great-uncle is no longer alive, so it's much harder to rebuild the family perspective. I think Jews have a little bit better sense of future because they have a little better sense of past. But it's a whole new way of thinking. And I think global warming is important. Like, I don't think we don't buy into doomsday prophecies. We don't feel the world's going to collapse. But it's a moral responsibility to worry about the future, not to mortgage the future based on the present. Why would you, my father, Baruch Hashem, and Mav Esrin. So he's 82 years old, and he just made a joke. He and my mom bought this fancy schmancy electric car, who knows how much it costs. So he's a big joker, my father. So he came and said, someone asked me, someone like you, your age, you're spending so much money on an electric car. He said, I told him, I'm taking the money from the kids, Because that's his death gallows joke, I'm taking from Yerusha. But would anyone here, imagine, you're an 80-year-old woman, and you've lived a life of philanthropy, and you've lived a life of moderation, and say, I've got X amount of dollars, then I go burn it on 15 cruises. No, you've made money, and part of living within your constraints is you want to help the next generation. You want to give them a solid footing. Again, where that balance lies. But they say, I'm 82, I'll just, do whatever I want. As my friend once told me, he had an uncle who was 95 years old, and very, very frugal, very, very financially responsible. At some point, they came to him at 95, 92 or something. They said, Uncle Jim, it's time to start spending some money. You're 92 years old. You should live it up a little, travel business class. And they came with a whole spreadsheet that even if he spends $20,000 more every year, he could still live another 10 years till 105 or something in comfort. So the guy looks at his nephew and says, and then what the hell am I going to do afterwards? Who's going to support me then? Okay, you'll be all right. You'll be 105, I think. You'll be fine. Anyway, so those are the things to think about. Yeah, it's an important time. Don't think of the short term. The short term is Lapid and Gantz and all that's Mishigas. Stupidity and waste your brain cells on these things. Politics is all passing and a joke. It's wiped away by time. So, you got long term issues, long term values. It's tough.
First of all, it's so funny because during orientation during college last year, I asked somebody in Kansas, how did your family end up in Kansas? And he just didn't know, which is the weirdest thing.
Okay.
But I was also going to ask, I got a lot of advice leaving Dallas last year. That I should be learning what I'm interested in learning. And that's been really great. But I feel like it's also leading a little bit to this self-gratification in my learning. And I was wondering what I do with that and how I prevent it and when to opt into learning that isn't necessarily what I'm interested in.
Okay, look, it's a first world problem. Right? So don't over exacerbate it. I'm learning, I'm really great, but it's an old question. On the one hand, enjoyment and gratification is absolutely crucial because it creates motivation, it creates internalization. When you're happy with something, it becomes part of you. When you're sad and frustrated, it's harder to internalize it. It's a thin balance between gratification and reverence, and it's something that our Chazal talk about in codes, because obviously they weren't psychological, so the terms weren't psychology, but you can find it in the Gemara. In the 19th century, there's a very famous introduction to a sefer called the Iglei Tal of Avram Bornstein, who was a sachacha, the first sachacha of Rabbi Talmud of the Kotsk. And he lambasts all those people who harangue against joy in learning. What do you mean, they said? You shouldn't be happy when you're learning. You shouldn't be enjoying it. He says, what do you mean? HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to have simcha. The higher of Nashem Lekin is the bitteros chabafinu. Now, obviously, there's a thin line between joy and self-aggrandizement and egotism, and you want to be seen in a certain way. Those are all toxic. Those are all noxious feelings. Is there something to be said about learning something that you're not enjoying just because you're exhibiting discipline and grit and commitment? Of course, but it's harder to sustain. So if you feel confident in yourself that you can sustain that, it's certainly the obedience and the reverence will be more pronounced. Because you don't enjoy what's there. A lot of people that are, accustomed to learning more analytical elements find halachic learning very draining because it's just information after information if it's not a broader analytical learning of halacha. But some people find bekiyas if they're more involved in iyun. Obviously, there are values to halacha and bekiyas respectively far beyond just the grit and discipline. Bekiyas gives you knowledge. Halacha obviously gives you the knowledge you need to perform a halachically responsible lifestyle. As long as you feel like, you know what you have to do? Let me just make sure it's after Levi, I'm going to go in a few minutes. Girls, this is really important, okay? So I had a couple of conversations. I had a conversation with an alumnus in South Africa, alumni. And you have to learn how to take your religious temperature. Namely, you have to learn to say, like, do I feel good as an Oved Hashem? And if the answer is yes, then don't freak out if it changes. And if, you know, in this case, the person wasn't learning as much because they had four kids and they were helping their wife and they're being super dad. And, you know, they came here all gloomy and doomy. I'm not learning anymore. She said, okay, but right now your Oved Hashem is to be a good father and a good parent and a good husband and whatever. You learn less. Like, it just, you have to be able to look inside of yourself and say, do I feel good about myself? Do I think Hashem is happy with me? Do I think... And you can't always break that down into mathematical decisions. Should I learn this? Should I learn that? And I think it's very important when you get married, like after dates, like, do I feel that this is making me feel better as an Oved Hashem? Because sometimes people bifurcate, you know. I think boys do it more often, you know. I'm serious in the base. Managing my girlfriend is just a chance to unwind and have a good time and relax and have someone to go out dating with and go to marry this. And then it's very schizophrenic. She's not part of your life, and obviously you can get married, she'll be part of your life, but it's very hard to weld it to your religious identity. So you just have to learn as you go through stages in life, and things are going to change, and you're going to learn different things and learn less and be, I don't know, in 10 years you may not go to Minyan anymore because you'll have X amount of children, you'll be running after them, and you know that your life's going to look very, very different. Be able to dig down deep inside and say, you know what, I just feel like I'm close to Hashem. And my closest to Hashem right now isn't being expressed by how many Tosas I learned, but it's being expressed by, you know, I have days like that where I feel closer to that Kadosh Baruch Hu when I don't learn than I do when I do learn, because I know I've served Chesed and I've worked hard for people, and just the way fate and circumstance had it, I really couldn't spend the time that I really wanted to. So I would say try to train yourself to take your religious temperature and look inside yourself and your neshama and say, you know, I feel good about myself. And even though I'm not sure, and a little different than that person, obviously you have to remain within halachic parameters, but and not to worry about the theory. I think too much theory sometimes is a little paralyzing. If you feel good about your learning, you feel like you're, you know, look at your davening as an expression. It's always a good litmus. If you feel like your davening is alive, then it's generally a good sign. If you feel like your davening is empty, it doesn't mean your religion is empty, it could just mean the davening. If it succeeds, it's a good sign. If it doesn't succeed, it's not necessarily an alarm. It means that it's just as hard in today's world to daven. But if your davening is fervent, it's normally a good sign that there's a religious health to you and what you're doing is making you. And especially for women, because in the end of the day, you have more leeway to build your religious fabric than men do. Men have a much more guided, telescopic, you have to do this, you have to do. In theory, a man lives every second of their life commanded. In theory, you have to learn Torah every minute you're not doing something else. There's no way around that. Now, the something else is, okay, there's life, there's rest, there's... But you don't have that albatross constantly, constantly chasing you. Are you learning? Are you learning? Are you learning? Are you learning? And therefore, you have more freedom to say, I'm going to build my fabric in a more diverse and personal way. Okay? I got to go to Levaya, so I will excuse myself.
I'm sorry.
Mirat Hashem, next week we'll have the not last end of the year share. We'll continue.
Q&A, or
if you want, you can ask me about it. I'll bring my cards and you can see which one you want.
I could keep going. I have more questions.
Okay. Always learn to question the question. Always look for values, not answers.